You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 26, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Zach Carter on the price of peace, money, democracy, and the life of John Maynard Keynes. Also on the program today, federal judge in Florida. Bill Clinton appointed federal judge in Florida. Rules that the Florida Republicans' felon voting restrictions are in fact a poll tax. Republicans want to claw back Planned Parenthood's paycheck protection loans. The World Health Organization halts testing of Trump's hydroxy because of higher mortality rates. Good news, senior sour on Trump. Bad news, Joe Biden getting advice from Rahm Emanuel. China tested 9 million people in 10 days. German government bails out Lufthansa, takes 20% of its stock. AP finds Cuomo sent 4,500 COVID patients to nursing homes, increasing deaths there. All this, your phone calls, your IMs, and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you had a good long weekend, as much as one can in this context. We appreciate your indulgence while we took the day off. Everybody needed one. It's a very weird doing the show in this context is very strange because, one, it is, I mean, I'm not speaking for the other guys, but, it's still not as comfortable as it is going into the office. It's not nearly as efficient. And it's stressful. And we're off our normal schedule. We didn't have our vacation, which we use to recharge ourselves, but it's a weird time to take like 5 days off because what are you going to do anyways? So having a day off here or there for everybody is very helpful, and we appreciate your indulgence. We don't do it that often where we don't put out content. I think I can count on my hand, maybe both hands. Over the course of 10 years, how many times we've done that where we put out no content whatsoever. Although, do we put out that members show? We do that deep archive thing?
Mm-hmm. Yep, oh. Chomsky, Harry Shearer, and Gore Vidal conversations.
Yeah. Sorry, we only brought you from the deep archive, Chomsky, Gore Vidal, and Harry Shearer for members. You can become a member. And then I guess just hope that we don't do a show. So you get a show like that. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And also, we now have merch. People are very excited about the merch. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. We got our merch there. So, and on the masks, all of the proceeds total go to the Pacific Northwest, Northwest Immigration Center. Pick up a mask if you want. I like the saying on it. All that and more. All right, let's jump right into this. Donald Trump is, and I will say this, you know, the CDC some time ago said that if states started opening up, they anticipated by early June, I don't know what that means, first week of June, early second week, nearly 3,000 deaths a day. Now, we are still in an area, I should say, in terms of temporally, where we wouldn't necessarily see the impact of things, loosening, as it were, around the country, because there's a 14 to 20 day lag time, seems to me, on deaths. And we also know that deaths are being, we know the data in certain states is being manipulated to make the deaths count seem lower. But we're only at about now, and only 1,500 deaths a day, which is horrible and not sustainable and untenable, but it's not at the 3,000. Now, the next week or two is really going to be telling, but there's obviously a lot of pressure to come out, just because it's summer. And this, when the president of the United States basically says, attacks any science that he doesn't like, that conflicts with his agenda, which is driven by the Chamber of Commerce and a bunch of wealthy Republican donors, which is, i.e., send everybody out, we can sustain all these deaths, no problem. He responds to it in this way. This is, he's being asked about the Columbia University COVID shutdown models.
A Columbia University analysis said that had the lockdown or social distancing happened sooner, the analysis said almost all of the lives that have been lost could have been saved. And then a New York Times reporter issued a tweet that implied you are culpable for those deaths.
You know, it's a disgrace what I watch from this fake news media and from some of these liberal institutions. Columbia is a liberal, disgraceful institution to write that, because all the people that they cater to were months after me. They said we shouldn't close it. I took tremendous heat. You know this. When I banned China from coming in, first time anything like that ever happened, I took tremendous heat, tremendous, like a level that I've never seen anything like it. And that went on for months. They were criticizing me. Sleepy Joe Biden said, I'm xenophobic, meaning I don't like people, certain people. And other people said, as bad as that or worse. And that was in January. And I saw that report. It's a disgrace that Columbia University would do it, playing right to their little group of people that tell them what to do.
Talking about...
Now, I should tell you a couple of things about that. One, xenophobic is... specifically, you have a problem with people who are strangers, specifically, you know, from different countries. But he's being interviewed by Cheryl Atkinson. Some of you may not remember her. She is now a reporter, and I think she has a show on a Sinclair Media. I don't know if it's, I imagine it's syndicated throughout all the Sinclair. Sinclair, of course, is the right-wing local network, if you will. And she was in the early, teens, I guess, 2011, 2012, she was with CBS News, and, she got very deep into the Benghazi thing. At times she claimed that the Obama administration was like, taking over her computer. She has in the past, suggested that there is a possible link between vaccines and autism. She just to give you a sense of how hardball those questions are. But this is what Donald Trump is doing in terms of the science. And this is what he does in terms of the science retroactively and going forward. We don't know that much about coronavirus, or I should say, we don't know everything there is to know about this. That's why they call it novel COVID-19, because it's new to human beings. We don't know if there's some data suggesting that over the 77 degrees, it becomes a lot harder to travel around. Plenty of data suggested it's harder to get when you're outside. All the scientists anticipate a second wave hitting in the fall, but some also argue like we're still in the first wave. It's just that we're choosing to ignore the 1,500 deaths a day. But understand that this is all a political decision by Donald Trump, driven by his desire, his belief that this is going to help him in the election, driven by the fact that he looks at spread and deaths of the virus. And if you were to look at blue states, ones that Clinton carried by big numbers versus ones that Trump carried by big numbers, less in the red states, of course, because it's less dense. To the extent that there's outbreaks there, they tend to be, and this is the true of blue states too, they tend to be amongst people living in poverty or people with low income who are forced to actually not isolate and semi-quarantine because they need to go out and get, they need to do their jobs, or they're afraid of getting fired. They need the money. And Trump's calculation is, my voters don't care about those people. And so we're just going to go forward as if nothing's happening. And my other constituency, Chamber of Commerce, and all these, whoever they are, the Koch brothers, the Mercers, whoever, are encouraging, open up, open up. So that's where we are. Meanwhile, the other constant in our, where are we here? Do we have, he is on the line. Okay, great. All right, well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Zach Carter on his new book. It's a big one. The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome, I believe, back to the program. He is a senior reporter with Huffington Post and the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zach Carter, welcome to the program.
Good to be back, Sam.
So, all right, let's start with the... let's start just historically from where he is, or maybe we should just in broad sense for folks, just give us the 60,000 foot view of John Maynard Keynes and how massive a figure he has been really in terms of how we perceive our economy, particularly I think from the 20s, maybe the 30s, into the really 80s, 90s across the board. But give us a sense of just where this guy is in terms of how much he has affected, in many respects, our everyday lives.
Sure. I think most of us, or at least most people who learn about John Maynard Keynes, learn about him in Econ 101 courses, where they're they're told, that he's the guy who said governments need to spend money during recessions in order to help lift the economy out of the doldrums. But Keynes was not this sort of deficit therapist guy who worked all his life to try and create a legacy where people talked about, you know, how much money you should spend when GDP reaches a certain particularly, you know, depressing point. He is, I think, really one of the most important kind of last Enlightenment style thinkers who looked at the world of economics as something that is sort of united and continuous with philosophy, ethics, political theory, the big questions that all of the major thinkers of the Enlightenment, like, you know, John Locke, John Stuart Mill, people like this, were concerned with. And when we talk about the economy, you know, even Keynes's most, I think, virulent critics, particularly on the right, use a sort of framework about talking about the economy that Keynes created. There was no such thing as macroeconomics before John Maynard Keynes came along. The idea of looking at the economy as this social thing that affects everybody rather than a series of atomized individual choices, that was a new way of looking at the world. And he developed that because he thought of economics as something that was not so much about dollars and cents and making equations balance just the right way, but that was part of a broader social and international project. He was trying to prevent catastrophes like the First World War using economic policy. And he spent most of his life on that project. In many ways, he failed over the course of his lifetime. But after his death, his ideas, some of them in a sort of narrow way, became part and parcel of the economics profession today. And I think if you go back and review the work that he was trying to do during his life, you can see that it's a much richer, much more robust, much more exciting set of ideas than I think what most of us receive from our Econ 101 courses.
I want to come back to this idea of in some ways of like his I think really developing almost the idea of a political economy in some way. But I want to come back to that after we go through some of the historical points, because the interesting thing if from my perspective about his life is that he really gets on the scene in terms of the Treaty of Versailles, which mm-hmm. of course happens in during a pandemic, and in many respects he has, you know, the much of the way that we're responding to this pandemic has been a function of his work. But talk about his opposition to the Treaty of Versailles, and there's just one interesting thing too about Woodrow Wilson. I know that he had a problem with Wilson abandoning his 14 points. Talk a little bit about that, because my understanding is that Wilson had the flu. And it go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not controversial that the negotiations for the Treaty of Versailles, which were taking place in 1919 at the close of World War I, that this became sort of a vector of contagion for one outbreak of what we call the Spanish flu. And Keynes himself certainly came down with it. There was actually a sort of infirmary on the rooftop of the hotel where he was staying, where there were so many people at the conference who were getting sick. They just had hospital beds, and he was laid out for weeks. And he has incredible memoirs that he wrote about feeling terrorized by the impressions that the patterns on the wallpaper were making on his brain. I mean, he was having hallucinations. It was very bad. We don't know if Wilson had the flu or not, but there is certainly evidence that he was behaving erratically, and we know he got sick. So there's certainly a case to be made that Wilson and Clemenceau, George Clemenceau, who was the French prime minister who was at the talks with him, both came down with it at different times. We don't know exactly how severe their strains were. The Spanish flu seemed to sort of, you know, evolve over time. So there were some strains that were more virulent than others. But Wilson certainly was never the same person that he was during World War One when he came back after the negotiations for the Treaty of Versailles. He eventually had a series of strokes and became totally incapacitated for the final years of his presidency. So with Wilson, it's not clear, did he have the flu? Did he have some strokes, some sort of minor strokes? Did the flu set off a series of strokes? You know, there are medical professionals who still argue about this, and I don't feel qualified to give a certain judgment one way or the other. But we did have a series of global calamities intersecting at the same time in 1918, 1919, with the First World War, and then also this global pandemic. And these are central to John Maynard Keynes's thought. Keynes is a very different kind of economist than most people who we describe as economists. You know, when you think about economics and what the discipline does, we're talking about rational individuals who are maximizing their self-interest in terms of monetary profit throughout most of their lives. And this idea for Keynes that we could be rational in the present without knowing what the future was going to bring was a very difficult concept for him. He didn't really believe in that. He was concerned with uncertainty, with the idea that the future is difficult to predict, not just in the way that, you know, can we predict, whether we're going to go to work tomorrow, but will there be, enormous events that will change the way that the world works that we don't see coming? Things like a pandemic, things like a war. And so his thinking, I think much more so than the sort of specifics about deficit spending, his thinking about how to deal with crises and how to deal with the unexpected is unique, really, in the history of economics, and is unique in the history of political theory. And when you go back and look at what he had to say, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, there's an awful lot in there that seems to me to be very compelling in our time.
And so he was an opponent of the Treaty of Versailles and felt that it was going that ultimately what came out was just far too harsh of treatment for Germany.
Yes. But not just Germany. I mean, Keynes felt like and this is very early in his thought. This is before he does the general theory and is talking about deficits or any of that. He's a very conventional economic thinker at this point in his life. It's 1918, 1919. He says, look, all these countries have spent all of this money and wasted all of these resources on this catastrophic war. They have their workforces have been decimated. Their resources have been decimated. There's just no way that these countries can afford to just make enormous payments to foreign allies or adversaries after this war. If we want to get going and have the same sort of international prosperity that he felt the world had enjoyed in the years before the war. So he's very critical of the reparations terms assessed against Germany, but he's also very critical of the continuance of the war debts that were accrued by basically everybody except the United States during what was then called the Great War. So Britain, France, essentially everybody on the Allied side. He just said we need to cancel all of the war debts, and we need to cancel these reparations ideas that are in the treaty, because if we don't do that, these countries will never get on their feet economically. They won't have the resources to take care of their people. And as a result, you're going to breed enmity between different peoples. It wouldn't just be an economic problem. It wouldn't just be about not having enough money to pay the bills. People in one country would start hating people in another country, and you would set the world up for dictatorship and war. So he was concerned about international harmony and about domestic stability. He was not concerned about making sure that accounts were paid. He felt like that was a silly priority to become obsessed with when these other big problems were lying in wait.
So, and it is around that time where, I mean, I guess he takes a little time to, I think, have some fun. It's like... in his life, but I want to get to, as he starts to develop, his sort of like broad principles of I guess Keynesianism, the idea of a macro economy, the relationship between money and finance to the real economy, and the idea that macro economy, must be managed for the good. I mean, how did he define that?
So Keynes came of age at Cambridge University at the turn of the 20th century, and he was not principally an economist. He was a philosopher. He fell in with this set of ethics and politics thinkers around a guy named G.E. Moore, who's one of the most important political philosophers ethical philosophers of the 20th century. And they were concerned with this vision of the good life. They thought, you know, what is it that you want to do with your everyday existence, with the arc of your time in the world? And they said, look, there are these sort of indissoluble, wonderful experiences that make up part of a good life, whether it's just appreciating a great piece of art, whether it's falling in love, whether it's enjoying a good joke. These are the things that you cannot break down into component parts. You want to maximize the number of these wonderful experiences in your life. And he came to believe that social harmony was something that could be achieved when everybody got to enjoy those experiences. This was very much a vision of the good life that was born of the British leisure class at this period in time. This is Cambridge University. These are not people who are, scraping to get by on meager wages in industrial factories. They are very well-to-do academics talking about art and ideas all the time. But he thinks that this is something that can be shared generally by the public. And he starts trying to figure out what the tactics are, what sort of strategies you could put in place to make sure that the abundance of the 20th century, which he believes, you know, we've just never had this level of pure material plenty in the history of the world, to make sure that abundance is distributed in such a way that people can enjoy the kind of life that he had at Cambridge at the turn of the 20th century. So he falls in with this group of artists and intellectuals called the Bloomsbury Set in London a few years after he's graduated. And he really tried, this is a group of people like E.M. Forster, like Virginia Woolf, very famous artists and writers who travel all over the world. They're hanging out with Pablo Picasso in Paris and Gertrude Stein and this big international milieu of sort of progressive intellectuals, let's say. And Keynes is very much part of this world, but he is also part of the very stuffy, button-down British Treasury world as well once the war breaks out. And so after the war, you know, he makes a lot of money off of that first book. It sells very, very well. The Economic Consequences of the Peace, his critique of the Treaty of Versailles, that makes him a wealthy man. And so he starts doing a lot of the things that not only well-to-do people at Cambridge University does, you know, he starts going off and, you know, doing fox hunting and all this crazy British aristocratic stuff. But he never loses sight of this vision of a society doing all of these things together. And that puts him at odds with the rest of the economics profession, where scarcity is really the sort of fundamental underlying principle. There's not enough stuff to go around. Economics exists in order to maximize how much we can produce at any given point in time. And Keynes comes to believe that that's not really the central question. The question is about distribution and social stability, not production. And I think even today, decades after Keynes was writing, that idea that economics is fundamentally about distribution rather than production is a very radical idea. If you are thinking about economics in terms of inequality, you're going to make different choices than you are if you're thinking about economics in terms of just sheer productive capacity. And I think pretty much everything that he did from the Treaty of Versailles going forward was an attempt to make sure that societies felt like they were part of the same project, that they would cohere, that people would want to work together to make the things that society needs in order to go forward, that they would not feel enmity towards each other, that they would not be set against each other in ways that, you know, I think it's pretty obvious in the United States, at least, we've been set against each other over the last few years.
So that fundamental difference in perspective, that the economy should be measured on the how many people are involved rather than what is produced, in terms of getting the benefits of that economy, is that big sort of bright line that that carries through. Yet he called himself a liberal socialist, or he subscribed to liberal socialism. Explain that, and let's talk a little bit about how those principles would fit into today's context.
Sure, and just to be clear, you know, Keynes wrote over the course of several decades, and he's, you know, his ideas at one moment in time are not the same as ideas at other moments in time. So there are different interpretations of his life that have been made before, but you know, which are not crazy. I just don't necessarily think they're right. And with the question of socialism, at times Keynes is very dismissive of it. He says that this is a silly project that makes very little sense. But he spends much of his time trying to develop what he calls a liberal socialism. He has a sketch that he writes in the 1920s called Prolegomena to a New Socialism. He's trying to imagine a way to keep together all of the things that he loves about the liberal Enlightenment tradition: individual liberty, freedom of conscience, the idea that you know, sovereigns should be restrained and should not have, you know, absolute power over their citizens, but try to fit that set of values with a world in which is confronting crises that it's never seen before. And so he comes to believe that the state is the only real vehicle that can provide the stability that people need and the financial security that people need, because markets, as they're understood at that point in time, are easily corrupted by uncertainty. And by uncertainty, I mean the inability to see what's coming forward and the ability to become sort of collectively depressed by your prospects for the future. I think it's a very easy concept to understand when times are bad, but it's very difficult to understand when times are good. And it's, the economics profession is often sort of just defined good times as normal, so that the bad times are sort of like an aberration or an exception or an asterisk to what to the way the world works. But at a time like now, you know, we don't know when the pandemic is going to abate. We don't know when people are going to feel comfortable going out and shopping again. We don't know when it's going to be safe to go out and shop again. There is a tremendous amount of uncertainty over the future. And under those conditions, I think people have a tendency to sort of retrench, to save, to protect themselves and hope for the best, rather than go out and do the things that an economy requires in order to produce the abundance that enables you know, the shared prosperity that Keynes was so enamored with. So if you don't go out and spend and do all of that stuff, you end up with an economy that just keeps shrinking. And I think for Keynes, this psychological problem was central to human beings. This was something that that affected us at all times, not just in the middle of a crisis, but it was something that we were susceptible to at any moment in time. And so you needed some sort of steady hand to steer the ship and say, okay, we're going to make sure that no matter what happens, you're going to be okay. And if you don't have that steady hand doing that, then people are prone to all sorts of outbursts of rage and irrationality. He didn't have a particularly generous view of working people. You know, he was often very dismissive of the ideas of the proletariat and things like that you would see in you know, more radical thinkers like Marx. But by the end of his life, he was saying, you know, we really need to socialize British medicine. He was the financial architect of the National Health Service and one of the most important political stewards of that project. It probably wouldn't have made its way through British Parliament had Keynes not sort of lent his prestige to it when he was meeting with lawmakers and talking about what an important project this was. So he's not just a deficit therapist. He's somebody who is willing to do very radical things politically, but in pursuit of, I think, fairly conservative goals. You know, he's trying to prevent social unrest. I think he would have been very frightened by the revolutionary rhetoric of the Bernie Sanders campaign, for instance. But you know, he may have actually found the Sanders campaign a little bit too timid on its policy platform.
Right. So the impetus for his
notions of government participation in the economy and the breadth and the depth of it. It's not a function of his belief that we need to democratize anything. It really is just simply a function of this is the most efficient way to achieve a goal. So there's maybe a shared goal, but the process part of it is a little bit more, I guess, centralized, if you will, in terms of who gets to decide what that goal is. But that government is very often the best vehicle to deal with the macro economy, I guess.
Well, to be clear, Keynes's views shift over time. So his most dismissive sort of nastiest things that he has to say about like the working class are from the 1920s. By the 1940s, he's a much mellower fellow. So I think he does want to democratize the elements of the good life in Bloomsbury, but he doesn't necessarily think that the working class as it existed in the 1920s was a set of people who were particularly receptive or interested in it. By the 1940s, he has a totally different view and thinks that the success of new medium like radio, for instance, which hadn't existed in the World War, that this had enabled people to appreciate new forms of things. And he starts talking about opening community theaters in every single neighborhood of every single town in Britain. So he does become, I think a small D Democrat eventually. But I think for much of his life, he's really concerned with a sort of Edmund Burke-like sense of social stability, that you want to avoid revolution. And the easiest way for the people on top to avoid revolution and to make sure that that the nice things that they like about their lives are not upended, is to throw not just some crumbs, but some real security to people who are not on top, because that will keep them from revolting.
Do you think, and I want to go to sort of like, you know, the sort of the Keynesianism without Keynes and what happens then. But do you think that he had a blind spot in terms of the idea that that dynamic where, you know, the wealthy have the good life and that they should be able, they should see it in their best interest to make sure that other people have at least a pretty good life to create that stability, sort of, I guess, missed. I mean, there seems to me to be a quality of like, no, it's not good enough that I have a good life. It's that like the dynamic between me and the rest of society has to be dramatic enough that for me to feel satiated, that there's a quality of like, it's not enough that I have $100 million. I need to have $50 billion or something, which, you know, there's no human being who can spend that kind of money, right? I mean, Bezos has said, like, I guess I'll have to do space exploration just to burn some of that cash or something. Was that a, I mean, do you think he could have conceived of that type of wealth disparity?
It's a remarkable thing that a man who is as brilliant as John Maynard Keynes had, in many ways, I think, a very naive view of not necessarily human beings more broadly, but certainly of the wealthy. And he genuinely believed that people wanted to enjoy life the way he had enjoyed it at Cambridge and in the Bloomsbury set.
Will you just explain the Bloomsbury set?
Why would you want to give up? Go ahead.
We just just expand a little bit on the Bloomsbury set. It's sort of like hippies, sort of, right? I mean, sort of like free love, like the summer of love.
Yeah, so it's sort of like turn of the century British hippies, I think. I mean, look, these people are always, they're artists and intellectuals and philosophers who are constantly swapping lovers. They are having dinner parties and drinking champagne and having their hair cut and holding art exhibitions and writing novels. You know, the most prominent member, I think, is Virginia Woolf. And I think the second most prominent member is John Maynard Keynes. But these are people who, you know, a lot of the names haven't survived quite as long in history as Keynes or Woolf. But these are people who are very, very prominent in the art and letters and intellectual scene of the time. I mean, they're contemporaries with people like Pablo Picasso. They are friends with people like Pablo Picasso. So, this is an extremely avant-garde, cutting-edge, certainly socially avant-garde set of people. And Keynes just can't understand why anybody wouldn't want to. Why? What's the point of having all of this money if you can't do what the Bloomsbury set can do? And if you can do what the Bloomsbury set can do, then what's the point of having a lot of money? I mean, the point is to do the actual thing. It's not to have a lot of zeros in your bank account. And you can't take it with you, as others have said. So he was. Not somebody who he was certainly not a person who of small appetites. He was all about doing these extravagant, grand, aesthetic things, whether they were sexual or just appreciating art. I mean, during the First World War, he even figured out a way to get the British Treasury to advance him a bunch of money to go buy a bunch of paintings from the Degas studio in Paris, which was putting up a bunch of stuff so that the Parisian government could raise money during the war. And he just thought, oh my goodness, we have this amazing opportunity to get these Degas and get them into the British Museum. And then he got some more money of his own and bought a few and brought them back to Bloomsbury. So he sees the good life as a set of activities, not as a bank account. And there's no real reason why those activities have to be exclusive for Keynes. When he gets into feuds later in his life with people like Friedrich Hayek, who is sort of the founder of neoliberal economics and of neoliberalism as a political theory, I think is even much more important than his actual economic contributions. Hayek has a view that scarcity is really central to the preservation of that kind of culture. That if you don't have scarcity is sort of the moment where you have to choose between different things. And if you don't have to choose between one thing or another, you never will make that choice. And so you need to have not only scarcity of resources, but a limit on who can participate in that type of culture. If you don't have that, then there will never be an aristocracy that forms that decides these things are good and we must pass down appreciation of these things between generations. And you will never develop the sort of cultural traditions that both he and Keynes thought were so important and so beautiful and so wonderful. Keynes just didn't share that belief. He thought there was nothing exclusive about this type of lifestyle, that people could enjoy it, that it would be a fine thing for everybody to like art and letters, just as fine, if not finer, than only a select few.
And so let's talk about that, that battle that begins very close to, I guess, more or less upon Keynes's death. I mean, I think that's probably more coincidental, because it's really about after World War II, when guys like Hayek go to Mont Pelerin and develop a competing theory of economics that was based on basically what you just laid out for us. Neoliberalism was, it ostensibly is just about markets, but it also pushes this notion that really there is a role for government and it should really basically promote the interests of a very narrow few that will ultimately benefit everybody else, as opposed to pursuing benefits for everybody. Talk about that, the sort of the dual, I guess, the competing philosophies, and when neoliberalism, maybe you would agree, wins out at one point, sometime in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, Hayek and his most sophisticated colleagues in the neoliberal movement, which begins in the 1940s, as you note, they don't think that markets are this sort of like natural state of affairs that governments then supervene on after the fact to redistribute things through taxes. They think that markets are things that are constructed by the government, and they're constructed to do specific things. And how you construct the market matters quite a bit. And so Hayek and his contemporaries, I mean, they feud. I mean, there's not one specific narrow conception of neoliberalism. There are all kinds of different people, some much more, I think, distasteful to contemporary eyes than others. I mean, there's some very virulently, openly racist strands of this movement, which, you know, I don't think it'd be fair to tar Hayek with, but I do think that they are generally united by the idea that without an upper class to create and transmit culture between generations, there cannot be high culture or high levels of human achievement. So they genuinely believe in inequality as a goal in and of itself. And this is why they end up, people like Hayek and Milton Friedman, who's one of his sort of most prominent disciples, I would say, though they have serious differences, particularly on economic policy, end up advising Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. The idea that someone is a brutal dictator is not great to these guys, but they would rather see, I mean, Hayek is very explicit. He says he'd rather see a dictator with what he calls liberal inclinations than a democracy without liberalism. But the liberalism that he's talking about is not the liberalism of the Democratic Party in the 1960s or 1980s or even today. It's you know, things like Social Security. He thinks that these things are essentially destructive to the public good and to the type of world that he wants to realize. By the 1970s,
and just to be clear, Hayek would refer to himself as a Dave Rubin liberal. That's it.
Well, you know, there's this idea out there right now that there's this thing called classical liberalism, right, which is the true thought of Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and John Locke and these people. And that vision is really not a fair representation of the views of those liberals. It's the view of those liberals that Friedrich Hayek and his disciples had.
Right.
You know, if you love individual liberty and religious freedom, I mean, John Locke wanted a state ban on Catholicism. So the idea that he represents the true form of you know, libertarianism in the 21st century, you know, that's very historically just kind of silly perspective. But this is the type of thinking that gets popularized by Hayek and his disciples in the middle of the 20th century, while they're pursuing you know, a lot of the ideas about property rights, for instance, that I think Locke would have found quite compelling. So there's this big battle over what liberalism means in the 1940s between Keynes and Hayek, and Hayek is really a fringe player in that battle. He pretty much gets crushed during his lifetime. And people don't have a lot of there's just not a whole lot of respect for him outside of the sort of aristocratic fringe of American politics. In Europe, he's totally he's totally sidelined. But after Keynes' death, they start to get some momentum, particularly in the 1960s when inflation starts to take off, because Keynes becomes associated not so much with these political ideas, but with the techniques that his disciples use to manage the economy. And when you start to have high levels of inflation, this seems to be an economic problem that Keynes is not prepared for. There's all sorts of, you know, complicated reasons why that I lay out in the book for why this comes to be seen as sort of central, as a devastating problem for Keynesian economics, when I don't think it really was. But because Keynesianism is thought to be incapable of grappling with this inflation problem, Friedman, who's a disciple of Hayek, sort of takes over and says, look, we can't have the state involved in these things. The state involvement in the economy is what is causing all of this inflation. We need to just step back and have economic management that's about just maintaining an adequate supply of money for the economy, and stop trying to regulate all of these other things. Stop trying to change the amount of demand in the economy when we slip into a recession. All that's doing is building up inflation, and now we're sort of reaping the whirlwind of all these previous bad decisions. That becomes the dominant view And it stays the dominant view really until the financial crisis of 2008, when people see what unregulated financial markets can do. But the truth is, we saw what unregulated financial markets could do throughout this period. They just weren't happening in the United States. There were financial crises throughout the 80s and 90s that were devastating in other parts of the world. And the types of Friedman-esque austerity regimes that were prescribed to deal with it were terrible for the people who lived in these countries, and also terrible for international stability. They fueled ethnic conflict and all the things that you know Keynes was worried that economic austerity could do. So I think since 2008 there's been a very big shift. You know, you don't have to be a liberal or a progressive in sort of the American terminology to be a Keynesian anymore. I think there are a lot of people on the right who are convinced not only of the economic wisdom of a lot of Keynesian thought, but of the political wisdom as well. But there isn't a whole lot of room for expression of that idea in our politics, because both parties, I think in the United States at least, are still, they're still sort of, they don't know how to deal with new ideas, and they've been sort of trained in this neoliberal school. So they even when they want to do something new, they're not sure who to turn to. It's sort of like Joe Biden talking about how he wants to have a big Rooseveltian, aggressive, grandiose economic program, and then turning to somebody like Larry Summers, who's fought against that for his entire career. It's not that Biden, he's not super confused about what he wants to do. I think he just doesn't know who else to turn to, and I think we're seeing a lot of that throughout the world, where there are political leaders who are sort of born and bred in the neoliberal era who just don't know what to do now that era has sort of come to a close.
And to be clear, what was it that you, inflation basically pushed Keynes out of the box. And in some respects, those who sort of carried on his legacy in the States in some ways took too many, were maybe too narrow in the way that they were projecting Keynesianism. So if, and then Clinton was the sort of the first, I think, Democrat, at least elected president, who made that shift. And this was following, obviously, Reagan and Thatcher, which I think was sort of like when that shift really, really started to take hold. So I guess in the end, like, what do you think if Joe Biden, and I will take your premise, because I think it's plausible that he wants to do something more ambitious, but has no way of understanding even what that means in some respects. Let's say, you were able to create Keynes in some type of laboratory. I don't want to get too involved in this, but I mean, look, you've written 600 pages on him. It's getting wild reviews. You have a very good sense of, like, hard to project where he would be if he was still alive in terms of like his thinking. But if you were to take the essence of his philosophy, like, what would you, two questions. Who would be the person you would want Joe Biden talking to? And what do you think that they would say?
Well, look, I mean, Joe Biden should talk to me. It's obviously the person that I would want Joe Biden to talk to. there are very few times in each generation when ideas really do matter, when new thinking has the ability to change the direction of the world. And I think we are in that moment right now. And I think we were in that moment in the 1960s as well, when Keynesianism sort of transformed from this, it is under the pressure of McCarthyism. So it's not like these people were just, totally venal, right wingers or something. I mean, there was a lot of pressure there was a belief that maybe the ideas and the structure of thinking about the economy that Keynes developed would completely go away. But the idea of Keynesianism is this scientific, mathematical, precise project. I think was very, very devastating for it in the 1970s, because you had people like Paul Samuelson who were interpreting Keynes and saying, look, we've looked at the data and it's very clear that you can't have inflation and unemployment at the same time. You have one or the other, and you can kind of manage the economy by having more unemployment or more inflation, but not both at the same time. So when you end up with both of them at the same time, it's devastating to the intellectual legitimacy of this project. I think by the time Clinton comes around, I don't necessarily think Bill Clinton is somebody who is sort of dyed in the wool as a neoliberal. That's just the intellectual hegemonic character of the times. This is considered science by the economics profession. All of the experts are saying this is the way the world works. And right now, all of the experts are kind of acknowledging they don't really know the way the world works. I mean, if you go back and read some of the stuff that Larry Summers has been saying, I mean, he's been trying to make up for some of the more damaging aspects of his legacy, but he's saying, you know, everything that we did before was wrong, and we have to come up with a new way of approaching it. You know, I think there are a lot of advisors to both the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren campaign who have been thinking about the economy the way that John Maynard Keynes thought about it. Not that there were these hard and fast rules where you could guarantee certain mathematical results by implementing particular policies, but that there are a set of values and a type of society that you want to realize and a set of sort of psychological conditions that you want to inculcate in society. And that if you attend to those psychological needs of your democracy, then you will get results that are much more prosperous, that people will in fact make more money and produce more stuff. That also corresponds with the international picture. Keynesianism is not just a domestic project of domestic prosperity. It's about international harmony and finding ways for different countries with frankly different values to get along. And I think the relationship between the United States and China has not simply degraded. It's just never really made a whole lot of sense. And finding a way to, I think, decoupling maybe too strong a word, but finding a way to not keep escalating the conflict between these two countries politically, while finding a way to economically for each country to take care of their own citizens, I think is a very serious project. And I don't have, you know, clear, I have a, you know, 12-point program to fix the relationship between the U.S. and China. But I think Keynes would have been able to say, we need to have a harmonious way to exist together. And in order to do that, we need to take care of our people. And there are some basic tools that the United States has never really implemented fully. You know, we don't have a functional healthcare system in the United States. The pandemic is laying that bare for all to see, but it was really clear before the pandemic arose. Our social safety net is porous and stingy, and we people do not have the support they need to embark on the creative kinds of lives, to take the risks, the entrepreneurial risks that we want to see people take to develop new ideas. And so our culture is not as vibrant as it could be. And I think he would tell Biden to attend to the type of world you want to see, not to the deficit or to the accounting technicalities that we associate with economics.
And so look at the world you want and then reverse engineer it on some level. But, so let me just ask you this. Why would he say, I have to ask this in this day and age, why would he say that socialism, and I know that's a fairly broad term, but what would his issue be with that as a process? I mean, because it sounds like, to a certain extent, many of the things that we consider to be socialism today, from a policy prescription, he would have no issue with, right?
It's a very complicated word. It's just a very complicated word for Keynes. I mean, he was an anti-authoritarian, so he was this fierce critic of the Stalinist regime in Russia. He would not want to see gulags and things like that. He liked the idea of society being organized in such a way that people were able to realize a good life. So the policies that you need to organize that good life, you know, he was fine with Social Security. He thought it was a great idea. There are people, including Milton Friedman, into the 1990s who were saying that Social Security and progressive taxation were pure socialism.
Right.
Is that socialism? I mean, you know, most people today do not think progressive taxation and Social Security are socialism. But if it is, then Keynes is definitely a socialist, right? Does Keynes want every industry in the country to be nationalized and to be put under the direct authority of the president? No, he would not want that. So he would be thinking about how to create policies that engineer prosperity. He would not have been dogmatic about a particular way to organize prosperity. There are some regions where of the economy where markets make perfect sense, and there are others where they don't make any sense at all. I think healthcare is a really clear example of that one. But you know, he would not have been doctrinaire about this, which is one of the problems with the idea of Keynesianism as an economic doctrine. He was a very versatile thinker. He could move on his feet, and he changed his mind several times over the course of his life. So he would want society to address the problems of inequality and instability. He would have found those to be just disastrous. And he'd see those as an emergency that needed to be addressed with the same level of vigor and intensity that you would address, you know, a foreign invasion in a war. I think he would find it hard to understand why our politics look the way they do.
Zach Carter, the book is The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much, and congratulations again on the book. It's getting great reviews, and I couldn't be happier for you. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, come back with the fun half. Joining us in the fun half, in fact, she'll be joining us in just a moment to tell us what's going on her show, will be Nomaki Konst. She will be here in just a moment. In the meantime, let me remind you, I'll wait for Nomaki to come on. Let me just remind you that you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get not only the free show, but you get extra content almost every single day. On days when we don't do a show, maybe you get even better content because we go into the deep archives. Back when Janine Garofalo and I hosted this program on Air America Radio, and when we used to get amazing guests in studio, because it was terrestrial radio with millions of people listening. So you can check that out. Also, AM Quickie, sign up for that. Totally free. Get in your box every day or your however you listen to your podcasts. 6 or 7 minutes of the daily news. Check out our merch shop. And don't forget the Majority Report blend. You can get it at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And Nomi.
Hi.
Hi. What's happening on your show this week?
What's happening on my show this week? We are talking about the art of the smear and how ostracism was used, has been used to silence dissent in its roots back in like ancient Greece. What else are we talking about? I taped it like a week ago, so I can't even remember now. We have an interview with Lindsay Boylan, who is challenging Representative Jerry Nadler. He has been there for over 30 years, and he's only passed 3 pieces of legislation, and they were vanity pieces of legislation. So, you know, the most unequal district in the country is the district that she is running to represent in New York. I mean, it's no surprise to us New Yorkers. So it's a good show. We're having a lot of fun on the show.
I spoke to her a while back. I thought she was instrumental in pushing him to push for impeachment too.
Yeah.
Her inclusion in the race. And also tonight is Tuesday. That means it's the Michael Brooks show. And you can check that out at patreon.com/TMBS or on YouTube, the Michael Brooks show. Matt, who's on tonight? Do you know?
I do not have the rundown yet, so no, but be a surprise, folks. Check it out.
I actually know who will be on TMBS tonight because I was going to book this guest for the Majority Report. It's Dustin Guastella.
Guastella, yeah. Cool. Yeah, he's a good guest. He's a union guy, Teamsters, I believe.
In Philadelphia?
Yeah, yeah. So and we've had him on before, but he's a great guest, actually. We should have him on Majority Report, definitely.
All right, great.
There we go.
Well, then, folks, check it out. Also, don't forget, check out The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada. A lot of new content. They're pumping out a ton of content every week. Matt, what's happening, Literary Hangover?
Yesterday, in lieu of the Majority Report, I Twitch streamed over at twitch.tv/literaryhangover, played some Red Dead Redemption, and learned about the frontier of the mythology and the metropolis from 1820 to 1845 and the emergence of the plantation and factory at that time, or just how they developed kind of in tandem. So twitch.tv/literaryhangover, folks.
I still don't, like, I just, like, imagine someone listening to this program for the first time and hearing what you're saying and being completely confused. And I have to say, even if you've been listening to pitch that Twitch stream every day, I feel like people would be like, what? Wait, what? It's playing a, what? Folks, and Nomi, maybe we'll talk about this in the fun half. We really have to deal with the elephant in the room here, obviously. There's a lot of issues surrounding my mustache that we better talk about in the fun half.
I was like, whoa.
It's highly controversial. It's probably, I think, Mike Cernovich and the mustache, the two times where I have, search terms on Google have gone up for me, I would say.
Oh, wow. People are literally searching. You went on cable, though, right? You went on MSNBC with it?
I did. I was probably the first person on MSNBC in a long time, contributor who with a mustache. I don't know.
Thomas Friedman. Come on.
Oh, that's true. Oy.
That's a Thomas Friedman mustache.
You look like a Jewish Mario brother.
Thank you. That's right. Thank you. I get a lot of that. Serpico. There's a whole.
Serpico is nice.
I know Serpico's not a Jewish Mario brother. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. We'll also take IMs on the app. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.